Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
I'm Sumi Somaskander from the Global Story podcast, where we're asking how the US election could impact the war in Ukraine. With Kamala Harris and Donald Trump neck and neck in the polls, President Zelensky's campaign to ensure crucial funds don't run out is increasingly uncertain. So will the result in November change his nation's fate? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from London. I'm Paul Henley. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has dismissed all calls for a ceasefire in Lebanon as airstrikes resumed on Beirut overnight. The latest Israeli attack on South Beirut, the militant group Hezbollah's main stronghold, was the first in several days. Today, warplanes pounded the city of Nabatieh in South Lebanon. The Lebanese health ministry said six people were killed there in strikes on municipal buildings, with the local mayor reported dead. The United Nations has warned of a catastrophic humanitarian crisis in Lebanon as huge numbers of people are displaced. We can talk now to the BBC's Jonathan Head in Beirut. Jonathan, what's the latest first on Israel's offensive?
Well, the city of Nabatieh you referred to there has been the most prominent attack that we've seen today. A lot of videos have been posted. I mean, really staggering numbers of explosions. Local residents told us at least nine almost at the same time. There might have been more. That city has been hit before. It was hit over the weekend when its historic Ottoman market was destroyed. Real scenes of appalling destruction in the city. You get a completely different perspective from the Israelis, who simply, they've said very little except that they've carried out multiple airstrikes against what they call terrorist targets in Nabatieh. We've heard the deputy chief of the Israeli Defense Forces saying this is how we dismantle Hezbollah's infrastructure. There is no other way. The UN Special Coordinator on Lebanon has come out and saying this is totally unacceptable, this level of civilian casualties. Mayor Ahmed Kahil was killed when his town hall was destroyed in this raid this morning in Nabatieh. Quite a few of his colleagues were killed. Local residents say he is just a very popular mayor who chose to stay behind when the Israelis ordered the city to be evacuated earlier this month, because there are people who won't or can't leave, and there are people who've come from other areas that he needed to help them. This is a Hezbollah-dominated area, but people say, well, he's a political mayor. Yes, he's Hezbollah, but he's a political public servant. So there's a huge difference in the views about why these places are being targeted, with a lot of anger here in Israel to see a town hall being hit like this.
How are people there and in Beirut coping?
As best they can. I mean, there is a fair amount of international aid that comes in. A lot of the Gulf states are sending in planes of aid. But this is an entire country in need. And it was, you know, suffering from a pretty severe economic crisis even before this war started. The government is weak. That's a known factor. So really, people have to help themselves. There are lots of families living with relatives. There are other communities who've taken strangers in, although they're beginning to fear that might bring in people who are targeted by the Israelis and bring a bomb on their heads. And lots of signs you see everywhere asking for donations, asking for food to help these massive number, you know, hundreds of thousands displaced. And I've been out to meet one man who runs a restaurant who's doing his little bit to help. So I'm strolling along Beirut's famous Corniche, the seaside promenade, popular with joggers, fishermen and street vendors. But these days there are also tents and groups of families sitting around who've been displaced by the Israeli bombing campaign. More than a million people, one-fifth of Lebanon's population, has been uprooted by the conflict, tens of thousands of them here in the capital in just the last few weeks. The needs are enormous and the government is unable to meet them. So ordinary people have stepped in to help each other. Well, we've come to a restaurant in Beirut's Hamra district. Like so many parts of the city, it's accommodating huge numbers
of people who've been displaced by the conflict. And this restaurant, Mezian, is doing its bit to help by offering free meals to those who've had to leave their homes.
My name is Jad Hamdan. I'm the operations manager of Mezian.
So what are you cooking here?
It's rice and meat with the sauce, with the like pepper sauce, and we distribute it to the people.
Tell me why you started this.
As you know, it's always bad situations here in Lebanon. Now this war displaced people from south, from Beirut suburbs. We are trying to do something, and as well at the restaurant, we are preparing food for these people to just help them with at least one meal per day. Because, you know, the prices now are really high, and maybe they're coming without their money, and some of them, they lost already their houses, their job. So we are trying to do something. So now we reach like 500 meals daily. You know, some apartments, four, five families, like 20 people in the same house. So we are trying our best to reach what we can do for them only.
And you're still running a normal restaurant business on top of this?
Exactly, exactly. I think the business is going down like by 70% from before. But at the same time, we're trying to help the displaced people here in Beirut.
So we're zipping through Beirut's crazy traffic. I'm on the back of a bike with Jad, carrying food for the Salum family. They've had to take in a lot of relatives in just one small apartment. Hello. So we've arrived. Shukran, thank you. So, Ali, how many people are living in this apartment?
Around 15.
15?
Yeah.
Very crowded.
Yeah. We are like a family.
A big family?
Yeah.
You don't know how long this will last, do you?
No, we don't know, but we are hoping to end very soon.
So no privacy for you here?
No, everywhere no privacy. And there's no safety, and everywhere is, maybe it's going to be bombing. No one knows. You're going to go outside on the street, and you don't know if you're going to come back or no.
You never feel safe?
No. Thanks, God. We are still alive for now.
That was Jonathan Head talking to the Salum family in Beirut. Now, faced with dual adversaries in the form of the invading Israeli army and the forces of Hezbollah, what are the official Lebanese armed forces doing to protect their country? General Khalil Helou served in the Lebanese army for 28 years before retiring in 2012. He's now a professor of geopolitics in Beirut, and he gave me his reaction first to the resumption of Israeli hostilities overnight.
Of course, I condemn this. Nevertheless, the presence of heavy weaponry and weapon storage in the middle of civilians by Hezbollah is also unacceptable. The problem is the bombardments of Israel are killing civilians.
And therefore, as the sovereign defense force of Lebanon, shouldn't the Lebanese army be doing something?
Yes, of course. But the story with the Lebanese army is very long. The Lebanese army is not in a comfortable position with the Lebanese government. The successive Lebanese governments, all of them, since 2010, they recognize the UNSCR 1701 that says ceasefire in South Lebanon, deployment of the army, withdrawal of Israel, and so on. And in the meantime, these governments were giving Hezbollah illegal coverage in order to arm and to resist Israel. This is a sort of schizophrenia. So the Lebanese army, if they want to implement the 1701 by force, this means civil war in Lebanon. And in any case, the Lebanese army can't do this without the order of the government, and the government will never order that.
Isn't it also true that the army is incapable of standing up because it is so under-resourced?
Standing up against whom? You know that the Lebanese army fought the terrorist organizations since 2007. When the Al-Qaeda tried to establish a base in North Lebanon, a real war of 100 days was carried out against Al-Qaeda, and we won.
But at the moment, you are facing an invading foreign force.
I agree with you. The Lebanese army equipment and the Lebanese army weapons, they do not match Israel at all. Israel is a superpower. Israel is the strongest power in the Middle East. Our budget is $2 billion per year compared to Israel that has a budget of $20 billion per year.
You also face the bizarre situation that the chief funder of the Israeli army and the Lebanese army is the U.S.
Yes, but the Lebanese army will defend its position if they are attacked by Israel. This is their duty, even though there is no balance of power. But the United States is an umbrella for Lebanon. We know that the United States are strategic allies of Israel. But in the meantime, without the United States, we won't have operational Lebanese army.
So given these unique circumstances, what you're actually advocating that the Lebanese army should do is precisely nothing.
No, the Lebanese army is the reserve of the Republic of Lebanon. And defending Lebanon is not only by tanks and aircraft and soldiers. Everyone knows that the strategy of defense has several bases. The first one is diplomacy. Second one is our friendship in the free world and in the Arab world. And the military role comes in the end.
But the military role now should be nothing, correct?
No, not at all. If the Lebanese army's positions in South Lebanon were attacked by Israel, they will defend themselves. Now, getting back to defense against Israel, the best defense we can have is to continue to rely on the United States in order to restrain Israel. Unfortunately, Hezbollah dragged us in this war without consulting neither the Lebanese army nor the Lebanese government.
And how well-resourced is the Lebanese army compared to Hezbollah?
Well, you cannot compare a regular army to a non-conventional force. Hezbollah is a formidable non-conventional force. The Lebanese army has a capable air force. We have a capable infantry, and our jewel of the crown are our special forces. The army is maintaining stability inside the country, is preventing Hezbollah from infiltrating or controlling the areas where he is not welcome, and preventing the other side also from any hostile action against Hezbollah. The Lebanese army has a non-conventional role, and you cannot compare it to any army of the world. And if there is peace, and there will be peace, at that moment, the Lebanese army will have a crucial role in order to deploy in South Lebanon. And this army, our army, is supported by the Lebanese population, whatever is their leaning toward Hezbollah or against Hezbollah. And our army, in that case, will be certainly backed by the free world and the Arab countries in order to deploy in South Lebanon and to implement once for all the 1701 resolution to restore peace and the sovereignty of the state in South Lebanon.
General Khalil Helou in Beirut. And later in the program, we'll be reporting on the humanitarian situation in Gaza after a U.S. ultimatum to Israel to get urgent aid into the north. A UNICEF spokesman tells us the situation for children in the Gaza Strip is worsening every day, with food, water and medicine shortages compounded by Israeli attacks and by severe restrictions on the amount of aid getting in. We'll also have another story of war from Sudan later, as a NewsHour colleague returns to his ruined childhood home near the capital, Khartoum. You're with the BBC World Service, live from London. This is NewsHour. I'm Paul Henley with NewsHour, live from the BBC. A British Member of Parliament is campaigning to have the UK join a small but growing list of countries banning smartphones in schools. A Safer Phones Bill aims to tackle addictive behaviour in under-16s and take what is already a subject of hot debate in the media, in classrooms and in pubs, into Parliament. Part of the plan is to raise the age at which children are able to give their consent to data sharing and stop apps targeting them personally with addictive material. These teenagers in the north of England are already aware they're overdoing it.
My TikTok average for hours per week is 42 hours.
Snapchat, definitely. Going through people's stories.
I'll sit there for hours and I'll think, just 5 more minutes and then I'll put it down and then I won't.
Well, I've been speaking to the MP campaigning for the change, whose name is Josh McAllister.
We've reached the point with smartphone use for children and doom scrolling on social media and all of the health, education and sleep effects of that, where I think we now need the equivalent of seatbelt legislation for smartphones for kids. And that's not just an issue here in the UK. We're seeing countries all around the world starting to take bold action on this same problem.
How would restricting data harvesting first stop doom scrolling, as you describe it?
One of the things that's happening, and actually children themselves say this, is that they feel captured by apps that use their data to then put that through an algorithm and feed back content to them that they struggle to walk away from.
The other element is some form of school ban, but most secondary schools have their own form of smartphone ban anyway during the school day, don't they?
Last week, there was a survey done of school teachers in England in which 38% of teachers had to deal with children taking phones out in the classroom. And that is in schools that have an effective ban in place. The issue is, how do we help everybody share some collective rules that makes it easier for parents, teachers and children to step away from content and devices that are proving to be really addictive?
There are good things about smartphones that not many parents or children would dispute. Travel apps are quite handy if trains are cancelled, buses have to be rerouted. And in a way, they're an aid to socialisation. Certainly you're the odd one out if you don't use a smartphone in your peer group as a 13-year-old now.
That's correct. But in the 1960s and 70s, when we were introducing seatbelts for cars, we weren't saying that cars weren't helpful. We were simply saying that we need to put some rules in place to make motor vehicles safer. At the time, there was all kinds of arguments against using seatbelts because it'd be a slippery slope. And it turned out, actually, it was good for the car industry and it was good for the public. And the same applies here. It's not about children not having devices. It's simply about trying to take away the most addictive features.
Where does the UK fit into the international picture here?
Other countries are now putting forward legislation and new rules. So whether that's Australia, and the Prime Minister's clear signal that they want to completely ban social media for under 16s, whether it's the state of New York passing legislation that's very similar to the private members bill that I'm proposing, or whether it's the president of France wanting to enforce a full phone-free school policy. So this is happening all around the world. I think countries are trying to figure out the best and most sensible way to put regulation in place. And it's good that that debate started here as well.
The British Labour Member of Parliament, Josh McAllister, who's campaigning to ban smartphones in schools here in the UK. Georgians will vote in parliamentary elections in 10 days' time in what is seen as a decisive moment for their country on the eastern fringe of Europe as it chooses whether to side with Russia or the West. There have been mass protests in Georgia recently against the so-called foreign agents law. That legislation was passed by the Georgian Dream, a party in power for the past 12 years. With its increased anti-Western rhetoric, it's hoping to extend its mandate, which the opposition says will be catastrophic for Georgia's democracy. The BBC's Rehan Dimitri explains what's at stake.
A rally for one of Georgia's pro-Western opposition coalitions in the city of Kutaisi. Our future is in Europe, cries one of its leaders. For many at the rally, the October 26 parliamentary elections are a referendum on Georgia's future, whether to be with Europe or with Russia.
We don't need Russia, because Russia occupied our country 20% or more.
Important for our country is that we have free economics, free education, and also justice.
Only Europe, no to Russia, says this voter.
Russia's war in Ukraine has featured prominently in the campaign of the governing Georgian Dream Party. Here in the capital Tbilisi, GD's blue posters are everywhere. They're billboards. Contrast images of war-torn Ukraine, showing bombed-out Ukrainian churches, burnt public buses and other scenes with their peaceful Georgian equivalents. Choose peace, not war, is their message. And that resonates with many in a country of 3.7 million which borders Russia and suffered a short but devastating conflict with its neighbour in 2008.
In Georgia's Black Sea town of Batumi, the billionaire founder of the governing Georgian dream, Bidzina Ivanishvili, is addressing a crowd of supporters. Mr. Ivanishvili made his fortune in Russia in the 1990s. And since the invasion of Ukraine, his governing party has gone out of its way not to offend Moscow, while also warning that the West wants to drag Georgia into Ukraine's war. He has promised to outlaw the country's main opposition party.
Today, the collective UNM, United National Movement, who are supported from abroad, is trying to come to power through unrest and get this country entangled in war and chaos. This is the end, once and for all.
But the real threat, says one of the leaders of the Coalition for Change, Nika Gvaramia, is the loss of Georgian democracy, along with a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to join the European Union.
There is no such thing as, some kind of threat to peace in Georgia. That's, Russian propaganda, definitely. It's not, so it's a dichotomy of peace and war. It's dichotomy of Europe and Russia.
Gvaramia's party and his coalition aims to attract Georgia's Gen Z voters. Earlier this year, tens of thousands of young people protested against a foreign influence bill, which they called the Russian Law. The law requires media and civil society groups funded from abroad to register as acting in the interests of a foreign power. Protesters saw it as a threat to the country's democracy and its future in Europe. The law was the final straw for Georgia's Western partners. Brussels has suspended the accession process for Georgia to join the EU. Washington has cancelled direct financial aid to the Georgian government and sanctioned some officials. Zviad Adzimbaya from the Fletcher School at Tufts University says the US sanctions are aimed at the authorities, not the Georgian population, 80% of whom say they want to be part of Europe.
Sanctions are terrible, but also an opportunity for the Georgians to wake up, honestly, really wake up, do one thing, nothing else, show up and vote.
That was the BBC's Rehan Dimitri reporting on the run-up to elections in Georgia. BBC World Service, this is NewsHour.
I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast, where we're asking how the U.S. election could impact the war in Ukraine. With Kamala Harris and Donald Trump neck and neck in the polls, President Zelensky's campaign to ensure crucial funds don't run out is increasingly uncertain. So will the result in November change his nation's fate? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to NewsHour. Now, here in the UK, the Football Association has announced that a German has been put in charge of the English national men's team. He's called Thomas Tuchel, and he'll be the third foreign national to take the job of coach. At a press briefing today, Mr. Tuchel was asked what his message would be to those who would have preferred an English selector.
I'm sorry, I just have a German passport, but I can just tell them, and I maybe everyone, all of these supporters also felt my passion for the English Premier League, my passion for the country, how I love to live here and how I love to work here.
Let's find out more from Rory Smith, who is chief soccer correspondent for the New York Times, based though in Northern England. He joins us now. Welcome, Rory. Who is Thomas Tuchel first?
Well, Thomas Tuchel is an extremely experienced, extremely able football coach. He's coached some of the biggest clubs in the world, Borussia Dortmund, Paris Saint-Germain, Bayern Munich, Chelsea. He's won domestic titles in France and Germany. He won the Champions League with Chelsea. He is an extremely talented coach, and he is, in a purely sporting sense, a real coup for the FA and for the English national team.
It shouldn't be controversial that he's not actually English, is it?
Well, not in some senses, but in others, yes, because international football, I think, is best seen as kind of a test of one nation's best in the football sphere against another. And that's how we view it in terms of players. You have to be, in the case of England, either English by birth or by ancestry or by naturalization to play for England. That's accepted. And I think it is a slightly strange discrepancy that the same doesn't apply to the coach, certainly for kind of powerhouse nations. I think in the case of developing football nations, an exception can be made for fairly obvious reasons that an experienced manager might be able to help improve the structures that are in place in those countries. I think for a country like England to hire a non-English coach, I think it's fair to read that as, it's not cheating, because there's nothing in the rules saying you can't do it, but it's certainly an admission of failure. It's an attempt to take a shortcut rather than solving a problem.
And how significant is the appointment? Because the English club football scene is the thing, and people don't care about the national team for what, years on end, and suddenly they're obsessed. How important is the job?
Yeah, the England job used to be described as the second most important job in the country, also described as the impossible job, but I'm guessing the FA don't really mention that on the application form. I think it is hugely significant. You're quite right, we do have a slightly strange relationship with the national team in that it's seen basically as a burden for 2 years, and fans tend to say, well, you know, there's an international break at the moment. Why is this interrupting the club football season, which is where a lot of the passion is directed? But then the European Championships or the World Cup roll around and it's all anyone talks about. So I think it's kind of a slow burn and then a sudden explosion of absolute scrutiny. Tuchel's described it today as the biggest job in world football. I think that is probably an exaggeration, but it's a job of huge importance to the English national psyche, and that can't be underestimated.
Rory Smith from the New York Times, many thanks. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Paul Henley. Now, this week marks 18 months since the civil war erupted in Sudan, leading to the world's worst humanitarian crisis, with millions displaced and, in some parts of the country, famine. The ongoing fighting is between two rival factions of the military government, the National Armed Forces and the RSF, or the Paramilitary Rapid Support Forces. The capital, Khartoum, has seen some of the most intense fighting. And for the first time since the war began, the BBC's Mohamed Hashim has returned to his birthplace of Omdurman on the opposite side of the Nile from the capital to search for his home, his family and his friends.
So I finally arrived in my neighborhood in Omdurman. Al-Morada Avenue is empty. The destruction is everywhere. Fronts of the houses are smashed. You can see the old slogans of the revolution are everywhere. I can see signs of the looting. Salaamu alaykum. So I just bumped into my neighbor, Haysam Shibeka. He's never left the neighborhood. And all the houses around him were occupied by the RSF. They were sleeping everywhere. And the extent of the devastation was total. Haysam lives opposite the masjid. We're now walking into the masjid for the prayer. The masjid appears to be fine. No signs of the destruction that you can see elsewhere.
Al-Hashmab is one of the old neighborhoods in the city. Our ancestors moved here in the late 19th century after they pledged allegiance to the Mahdi, the founder of Omdurman. My mother's grandfather built this mosque in the 1930s, and it is reassuring to come and find the faithful still hold their prayers here. It's strange to attend the mosque with so few people attending a Friday prayer. Only three rows. I leave the mosque to visit my second cousin, Wafa.
She stayed alone in the house with a couple of ladies. And I don't know what she's going to tell me. And I don't think she's expecting me. So it's going to be a surprise for her. Salaamu alaikum.
Kulla kanat irhab. Kulla kanat istiqlal istihdaf.
My aunt Wafa tells me of the ordeals they endured. She speaks of intimidation, theft, physical and verbal abuse, and terror.
It's good that I managed to come and visit my auntie Wafa. It's reassuring that she's managed to survive the worst month. But she's still standing. They've stolen everything she has, but she's relying on Allah and her faith.
It is time to see my house. This is possibly the hardest bit of this journey, visiting my family home where I grew up as a child.
I'm looking at the house before I go inside because I feel it's going to be heavy. Let's go into the house, I guess. Everything has been looted or destroyed or damaged.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Look at the destruction of it. Thank God that the pictures and the photographs are here. This is a diary of RSF soldiers stating the number of the force that was stationed here on the 3rd of October 2023. There were 35 RSF fighters here. The guy in charge, his name is Mahmoud, and what they had in terms of rations. Evidence of war. That's my father's PhD, a copy of it. And my grandmother's prayer beads. How is this war going to end? I don't know. Inshallah, God willing, one day we'll be able to come back. And the people who used to live here will try and build new lives.
And my NewsHour colleague, Mo Hashim, fresh back from his trip to Omdurman, joins me in the studio now. Mo, welcome back. Your main impression in that really difficult to make personal report was of the damage caused by the RSF, the paramilitary, but there have been atrocities on both sides of this conflict, haven't there?
Absolutely, you're right. The United Nations fact-finding mission has issued a report accusing the Rapid Support Forces of committing war crimes, and they equally accused the Sudanese army of committing war crimes, mostly relating to aerial bombing of civilian areas. Only this week, we heard reports of a market in the south of Khartoum that was bombed by the Sudanese military. But equally, they are accused of arbitrary detention of activists and civilians and torture. During that visit to Sudan, we've put these allegations to several senior officers. And General Ibrahim Jaber, who's a very senior figure and a member of the Sovereign Council, told the BBC that the Sudanese armed forces are not angels. They accept that there are issues that happen within the behavior of war, but their recourse to it is that this war was imposed on them and that the nature of urban warfare makes it very difficult to times secure that areas where they know there is a presence of the Rapid Support Forces is difficult to be bombed. That's what the Sudanese military would say.
And 18 months on from the start of this war, is there no real sign of any let-up?
As we speak, there's been an uptick in the military operations in the west of the country, in Darfur and in the Sudanese capital for the last 2 weeks. The Sudanese army has carried out quite a large offensive on the Rapid Support Forces in Khartoum North and in Khartoum proper. And with the peace talks, it doesn't seem that at the moment there is a way out of it.
And just a reminder of the scale of this, I described it in the introduction as the world's worst humanitarian crisis, which will surprise many listeners used to hearing about Ukraine, about Gaza.
Absolutely. It's the largest displacement crisis on the planet. There is a good 10 to 11 million who are displaced internally and 3 million are refugees. But there is also parts of the country that are facing famine, and the people who could face severe hunger is estimated at around up to 20 to 25 million people. That's more than 50% of the country's population.
And foreign interventions, there have been efforts to broker peace, haven't there?
There have been, but they have been stalling. One of the key issues is from the perspective of the Sudanese army is that the U.S. Interlocutor mediator, Mr. Tom Perriello, for example, hasn't visited Sudan. And there'd been an agreement in Jeddah that neither party appears to have honored.
Mo, many thanks for now. That's Mohanad Hashim, fresh back from a trip to his native Sudan. Now, a new museum celebrating the wonders of ancient Egypt has opened its galleries next to the pyramids just outside Cairo. The Grand Egyptian Museum will house the largest collection of ancient Egyptian artifacts in the world. It's cost more than $1 billion and has taken over 2 decades to build. Its construction held up by rising costs, political problems, and the pandemic. Here's what some of the first visitors to the museum had to say.
We are so happy to be here to visit these beautiful sculptures, and it's possible to compare with such museums like in Abu Dhabi, in England and all over the world. It so amazed us. It's very modern, and at the same time we can touch ancient.
There's a lot of history. There's a lot of things that we are not aware of, especially coming from the other side of the world, and seeing everything here and learning from the locals, it's been great.
Well, I've been speaking to another early visitor to the museum, Salima Ikram, who is a distinguished professor of Egyptology at the American University of Cairo.
This is the first day that the museum is properly open, and now I am standing inside the Middle Kingdom room, and I'm surrounded by these beautiful cases, which are well lit, and there are boat models on one side, animals made out of wood and papier-mâché. And then the other side is statues of all kinds of people, old and young, sitting and standing. Fantastic and beautifully coloured hieroglyphs.
Why is such a collection so important to the world, would you say?
Well, I mean, being an Egyptologist, of course, I'm biased. But I do think that having all of these objects from the continual history of ancient Egypt, starting from 5000 BC, going into the Roman era, in one place is a spectacular way of engaging with history and seeing things that go from all over Egypt. So it is not just, you know, a continuum spectrum of history, but also changes in how writing developed, religion changed, and customs have evolved, and the view of kingship also changing over time, or maybe not quite so much changing.
It must be to an extent a political statement by the government saying that they have this state-of-the-art facility to show off Egyptian history best.
Indeed, I think that museums and artifacts have always been used for political ends by either their own government or someone else's. And certainly here, this is a grand statement saying that Egypt is both an ancient and a modern country, and it has a vast history that the world should reckon with.
I wonder if there's a particular exhibit you can focus on just for a moment to explain the importance of this museum, something you're looking at now.
There is one of the most extraordinary displays that I have ever seen here. And we know that the ancient Egyptians wrote a lot, but how they learnt to write is something that we don't know as much about. And what they do have are these wooden boards which have been covered with a thin layer of plaster, and then people would write on them, and then you could wash it off and practice. And some of them bearing the last owner's sort of imprint. So some of them have got sketches, other ones have texts, some of them have corrections. For someone who teaches, of course, it's quite nice to see that, because although there are computers, I still do get people to write me my essays by hand sometimes. And so it's quite a lovely thing to see someone's corrections 3,000 years later.
There's more to come from this museum, isn't there, as well, when it fully opens?
Oh, absolutely. Of course, what everyone else is waiting for is the great Tutankhamun Gallery, which is still closed. And I suppose once the glitches have been worked out from these other 11 galleries that are now open, that will be the grand finale.
Salima Ikram, who is a distinguished university professor of Egyptology at the American University, speaking to us from inside the newly opened Grand Egyptian Museum today in Cairo. You're listening to the BBC World Service. We're live from London. We're NewsHour. I'm Paul Henley, and this is NewsHour, live from the BBC in London. Israel has allowed the first aid supplies for 2 weeks to enter northern Gaza following pressure from the United States. The US government has given Israel 30 days to boost humanitarian access to Gaza or risk cuts in military assistance from Washington. The message came in a leaked letter which has been verified by the BBC. It demands urgent and sustained action by the Israeli government to reverse the deteriorating humanitarian situation. Well, a new statement from the Israeli military says 50 trucks carrying aid, including food, water and medical supplies provided by Jordan, were transferred today to the northern Gaza Strip. The IDF says it is acting in accordance with international law. But speaking to the BBC, an Israeli politician whose religious Zionism party is part of the Prime Minister's ruling coalition, Simcha Rothman, said he believed the aid deliveries were being used by Hamas to generate funds. He also claimed that food supplies to Gaza were already more than sufficient for the population's needs.
It's not true that there is no food in Gaza. This humanitarian aid that gets to Gaza is directly serving Hamas. Many trucks of humanitarian aid goes directly to Hamas. The accusation that Israel is preventing humanitarian aid when the amount of calories per person in Gaza, even now, is way more than the international standard, and Israel allows it.
Saib Al-Zad is close to the coast in northern Gaza, not far from the Jabalia refugee camp. He explained to the BBC what the food situation was like there.
The food problem is very bad, to be honest. Like, in this war, we miss all kind of natural food, if I can say that. Like, it's been a year without chicken or meat or, like, vegetables or fruit. It's so expensive if you sow it. So it's like you bear not to see it. I mean, in the market, you can find, for example, only one man who got meat, let's say, but like the price would be so expensive and he cannot sell it to anyone, only maybe like few person who can buy it from there. So it's you can see it's not found. We eat only food in cans, you know, but now also the cans are missed from the market. You can't find it, but thanks God we have bread. To get the bread, it was for us, it was a very big challenge. You could lose your life for getting a bread, and now we feel thankful that we have bread.
The head of UNRWA, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, Felipe Lazzarini, said more trucks needed to be allowed into Gaza.
Over the last 2-3 weeks, there was no convoy entering into the north, except yesterday with the announcement of 30 trucks, and we have been a huge drop of convoys in the south, with only an average of 50-60 for 2 million people, while we estimate the number needed much, much higher. And the few convoys which entered, because of the total breakdown of the law and order, have also been looted.
Let's speak live to a spokesperson for UNICEF, James Elder, who was in Gaza until earlier this month. James, welcome to the programme. Has there been positive progress? Because for the third day running since that letter was sent from top US officials, trucks have been going in.
Yeah, I mean, with the horrendously low baseline of no trucks going in. I mean, so commercial traffic, you've got two parts of this, as the head of UNRWA just mentioned, Paul. You've got commercial traffic. That's essential to the well-being of Palestinian children and families. Humanitarian assistance can't sustain 2 million people. So those two things need to complement each other. But yeah, in September, commercial trucks were reduced to 50 a day, a fraction of what is needed, and not a single commercial truck, not one, was allowed to get into the north. So yes, in the last couple of days, under this horrendous, very low baseline that has been forced upon people, I guess there have been improvements. Remembering those people in the north, not only have been deprived huge amounts of food aid, they've come under immense fire. There's been 3 forced evacuations in the last 7 days. Wells, bakeries, lots of people being shot as they flee. So there are a lot of challenges for people in the north.
You heard one refugee earlier saying that for many months now, no fresh meat, fruit, or vegetables. What are people living off?
Yeah, it's look, flour, you can't survive on flour. I heard that discussion on calorie intake. It's just not a good metric. This is about dietary diversity and nutritious products. And as of September, it was like 85% of children face severe food poverty and don't consume, you know, even two types of food a day. What that means, Paul, is that their immune systems now are terribly weak. And so children have very weak immune systems because this has gone on for a year. They lack access to safe water and hygiene. And so when they get sick, they most certainly cannot go to a hospital. I mean, I know those hospitals very well. They are movie-like war zones. They are overflowing with civilians and children with horrendous wounds from bombs. So we are in that same place that we really were a year ago, amid forced evacuations, continual numeric denials and delays of aid. We find the international community watching history repeat itself, fed the same misleading narratives and fully aware of the deadly consequences that are going to follow today and tomorrow for Gaza's children.
What about health for pregnant women?
Well, disastrous. I have the numbers, but some of the just the personal stories. It was my fourth trip to Gaza, Paul, this month, and speaking to women who, for example, had just given birth, who were unable to breastfeed simply because they were malnourished and there was no possible way they could access formula on the open market. Anecdotally, it does seem talking to doctors, they are seeing many, many more pregnant women give birth prematurely. Of course, most of those births again happen at home because it's very unsafe to try and move. 85% of the Gaza Strip is now under some sort of forced evacuation. So in what was already a very densely, one of the most densely populated places on the planet, now people are squashed into ever more unlivable situations. So it's for pregnant women, it's one of the worst scenarios because they know they don't have the nutrition for themselves. They certainly don't have it for their newborns.
You heard that point, sorry to interrupt, raised by an Israeli MP about Hamas using the food that is delivered for resources or looting it. Have you seen that for yourself?
There's a couple of things. I've been to Gaza four times and I've walked through. I spend every day in communities and hospitals and so on. Have I seen an active presence of Hamas? No. Does that mean they're not there? No. Does it mean is there looting by civilians? Yes. Does the vast majority of humanitarian aid go to the civilian population? Without a shadow of a doubt. And there are ways to address this law and order as well. And we've been, you know, lobbying for those for a very long time. We need more roads and alternate routes, Paul. That's a very critical area. Right now, we don't have that, and that's Israel's obligation.
James Elder for UNICEF. Thank you. That was NewsHour.
The race to become the next president of the United States is on.
We can't drop the pace now.
Yeah, it's pretty close.
Count on the BBC World Service to keep you informed on the latest breaking news, with insight and analysis you can trust.
Immigration, if you look at polls, a top concern for so many U.S. voters.
The issue of the economy reigns supreme for everybody.
For a global perspective on the U.S. election, search for The Global Story, the documentary, and the Global News Podcast, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.